Let's say you grew up not in the Eden of the rural South, but in a public housing project on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. So, you're either black or Hispanic. Or you're sociologist Dalton Conley, the author of Honky, told Steve Paulson how a nice white boy like him came to grow up in the ghetto. Of course, it's all his mother's fault.
She was trying to make it as a writer, and my dad was trying to make it as an artist. They had no money in the 1960s, living in sort of a walk-up railroad-type tenement apartment. They had been repeatedly burglarized, and one time the criminal was caught red-handed, and he vowed to come back and kill them when he got out. Now, whether that's true or how serious he was is another question, but my mother took it seriously and said, we got to move now. And this opportunity, this opening in subsidized housing came up. My mother went and looked at it, thought it looked good, and grabbed it at the time.
So what was the racial makeup of this housing project?
The predominant group was actually Puerto Rican and then African American as well.
And how old were you when you moved there?
They moved shortly before I was born, and I lived there until high school.
So what was this like for you when you were really young, when you were just learning about race? How did it become clear that you were different than most of the kids around you?
It certainly was a process I had to learn. I start the book with the story of kidnapping a baby in the playground of the complex because I so desperately wanted a baby sister. And it turned out not only was she African American, she was the daughter of the local black separatist leaders. And I think I confirmed their worst nightmares about white people, that we actually do want to steal their babies. But
you were what, 2 years old at the time?
Almost three. And my mother liked to tell me that story over and over again when I was growing up, when I did have a real baby sister. Her moral of telling me this story was, you should be nice to your sister because you had wanted her so desperately. And that went right over my head. And what I took away was, God, how could I have been so oblivious to something that's so innate to me now, that skin color is the most important physical distinction.
But what that story suggests is that when you were not quite three, you didn't make that distinction between black and white.
No, that's something that we're, you know, how tall or short somebody is much more important to a kid in the playground than what color their skin is. It's only when I ironically got to the institutions in society that are supposed to promote equal opportunity and color blindness that I learned the importance of skin color for all sorts of social reasons.
You're saying when you got to school.
Right. The biggest lesson I remember was in first grade when I was the only white kid in otherwise all black class. And not coincidentally, I was the only kid not beaten by the teacher. She herself was African American. And many of the other parents had, in fact, requested corporal punishment for their kids to, quote, keep them in line, which to me makes sense in a rough and tumble neighborhood. You want put a premium on authority and discipline. At the same time, the teacher knew that, quote, white parents spoil their kids, and I think actually deep down would never have crossed the racial line to hit a white kid. So that was my first lesson about why skin color mattered or how it mattered.
That must have been pretty strange, too. I mean, on the one hand, it's obviously nice that you're not getting beaten in the class, but you're singled out, and every other kid in the class must notice that.
Oh, for sure. I got a very tangible case of white guilt in that I started twitching and having facial tics and all these nervous habits that alerted my mother that something was wrong there, and she went to investigate in the school. My sister's lesson about race came even earlier. She was in the Head Start program, in which she was, again, the only white kid. And on Christmas, one year, was the only kid to get a white Barbie when all the other kids got black Kenner Barbie dolls. And she got stampeded by the other kids who, quote, wanted a real Barbie. So as the teachers were yelling over the din, black is beautiful, black is beautiful, the kids shouted back, we want Barbie, and tried to trade theirs for hers. All of a sudden she realized, I'm different in some fundamental way, that through school and the media, all the other kids had learned too. And then the ultimate lesson was actually when things went from bad to worse in my elementary school, and a kid got castrated by a sexual predator in the bathroom at the end of that school year, and my mother said enough is enough and got me out of that school, and I started going to school in a predominantly white part of town, in a predominantly white school, in well-off economically school, then when I had to start shifting back and forth from 9 to 3 in this community and then back in my home neighborhood after 3, then I really, really got the message about what race and class meant in America.
Did you feel more comfortable going to this other school, the predominantly white school?
I think for many years I didn't feel comfortable in either situation. For example, in my original school and in the playgrounds of my neighborhood, it was quite clear why kids were popular. A kid was fast, big and strong, really humorous, could tell good snaps on other kids. It was about what they brought to the table or to the playground. At first, when I went to the other school, I was just confused about why the kids who seemed to me the most nerdy couldn't tell a snap if their life depended on it. Why were they the most popular? It seemed like an alternative universe where I didn't really understand the rules or the hierarchies at all. Only spending time in their homes after school did I realize, oh, it's not about the kids themselves. It's about their family background. It's about class. The kids who come from the richest families, the kids who come from parents who have prestigious jobs, they were the more popular kids, no matter what their individual attributes were. Everyone wanted to be friends with them.
Really, that's interesting, because I wouldn't think that's obvious, that kids would care that much about whose parents they have.
Well, in my old neighborhood, those kind of distinctions were all leveled, because everyone was more or less in the same community. I mean, some people were on welfare, some people were just on food stamps, and that was always a source of snapping. But overall, everyone was in the same boat economically. In this new neighborhood, yeah, it did matter a lot that this one kid I remember, Barrett Esposito, had a whole brownstone to him, to his own family, and had a whole entire playroom downstairs that was well-stocked with Coke. I remember he had the image is burned in my mind that he had a closet full of cans of Coca-Cola, and everyone wanted to be his friend.
Now, one thing that happened is that you made it from your earlier school experience. You went to this nice school in Greenwich Village. You later went on to one of the best high schools in New York City. You have since gone on to a celebrated academic career. And I'm guessing that you were kind of unusual in terms of the people who came out of that neighborhood where you grew up.
For sure, unusual. Not the only one who's had what you call conventional socioeconomic success or something like that. But I attribute it to all the things I've been writing about and talking about. We always talk about how race matters or doesn't matter. We debate this endlessly for blacks and for Latinos and other minority groups. But we don't talk about how it matters or doesn't matter for whites. And that's one of the important aspects that I know from my own experience. I was playing after school with a friend of mine on the rich side of town, and we were playing a very dumb game called Fireman Waterman. And I was fireman, and my job was to strike matches and throw them lit matches at my friend who was waterman and had a mister for plants or for hair and would put them out. And needless to say, I won, and I won big because I burned down most of his apartment. Now, anyway, the fire department came, put out the fire. Then after they came, the fire marshals and police came and conducted an investigation, and they interviewed us each separately and the parents and so on. And at the end they said, you know what? Good kids, really stupid activity. Why don't you discipline them? We'll leave it to the families to work this out. Now, that moment, I think, encapsulates the power of race in America. Because had that been back in my own neighborhood, had I been black or Puerto Rican myself, I think things wouldn't have been handled so informally. Of course, there's equal protection under the law, but the law can be selectively applied when it's convenient. And had I been prosecuted to the full extent of the law, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you as a, quote, success. You know, I wouldn't have gotten into college, and then other things might have cascaded from there. Luckily for my book examples, unluckily for me personally, for my political preferences, George Bush is now president, and he provides another great example. Bush and Cheney both had DUI, driving while intoxicated, convictions. Cheney had 2, in fact, from the 60s. Now, that didn't knock them off their track. Having a drinking problem for many years of his adulthood didn't knock him off his track. Running a business into a ground didn't knock him off his track, because he had enormous class and racial privileges that he kept getting written new free checks or free passes. I think that's part of what whites take for granted in terms of the power of race.
Dalton Conley tells the story of growing up in two worlds in his book, Honky, just out in paperback. Steve Paulson talked with him.